Who says he can't do that on Yom Tiv? Why is it that Yom Tiv and Avelos are mutually exclusive? The pe'ulos of Yom Tiv and Aval could do, and the pe'ulos of Avelos, somebody who's celebrating the regel can do. Why is it that the Gemara says, Avel eino noeg avelus of a regel? So he says in this context, that the mutual exclusivity of both of them is not on the level of the pe'ulos ha-mitzvah. It's not on the level of the maisa mitzvah in a chinami. Each one could do what the other one has to do. But the mutual exclusivity stems from the religion in essence. It stems not from the religion in manifestation. It stems from the feelings that are engendered by Avelus and by Simchas Yom. They engender opposite sentiments. Avelus Nebuch, you feel far from God. You feel, as he says earlier, at the top of page 4, in the middle of page 4, it's an inner experience of black despair, of complete existential failure, of the absurdity of being. It overwhelms man. It shatters your faith. It exposes your eye awareness as a delusion. You feel Nebuch far from God. You feel somehow distant. You lose the most precious being in your life, and you feel alienated. You feel somehow separate. What's Simchas Yom Tiv? The opposite. Mamish, exactly the opposite. Simchas Yom Tiv is not just eat the meat and drink the wine and have the beautiful jewelry and give the kids the candies. Simchas Yom Tiv is the opposite. Simchas Yom Tiv is feel God in your face. Feel the Ribbono Shalom right here. Live a life, Nei Hashem. And to try to take that feeling with you past Yom Tiv, and to take the Lifnei Hashem experience into your daily life. Can there be a greater mutually exclusive set of sentiments than this? On the one hand, to feel distant and alienated and removed. On the other hand, to feel close, intertwined, mamish. Kaviyachol pe'al pe'a daberbo. That's why Avel eino noheg avelusa biyamtiv, because the religion in essence is what's mutually exclusive, not the religion in manifestation. The last quote here comes from one of Rabbi Ziegler's books, Family Redeemed. There's a whole really very interesting chapter on the relationship between children and parents. And once again, the Rav uses this kind of terminology, that kibud av menmora avayim is not just doing, but it's also feeling. You don't throw the food at them or even give it to them nicely and meanwhile be resentful. But you have to do it with the varmkeit, with the ahava, with the kavod, with the respect, not only the religion in manifestation, but also the religion in essence. I've attempted very, very briefly to just share with you a few quotes from the Rav on this very important subject, and to try to help us, whether we're wonderful Jews or whether we're wonderful Jews and wonderful teachers of Jewish children, to try to understand the centrality of both of these very important issues, and to try to see how it plays itself out in various different educational formats. We're very much looking forward to hear what the distinguished panelists have to say. Thank you very much.
I want to address an additional level of this question, and then I want to address one more dimension of this question and try to see its practical application. Rav Schechter, in his very enlightening presentation, tried to explain what is the importance of the inner and the outer, why we need both, what the two dimensions of essence and manifestation are. He pointed to two major reasons why. I think that in terms of Jews who are committed to halacha, we understand the outer, Torah Misinai, mitzvot, we have to keep the outer. What the Rav, generally addressing an audience of committed people, tried to stress was, given that you all accept the need for the outer manifestation of Judaism, the Kiyum HaMitzvot, he wanted to try to persuade the audience of the necessity of the inner element. That, you know, it's not enough just to do the actions, but it has to be accompanied by an internal experience. And Rav Schechter pointed to, I think, two major causes. In some mitzvot, the actual kiyum of the mitzvah takes place on the internal level. The mitzvot that he mentioned, such as Avelus and Chasyom Tov, Tefillah, etc. But that's a narrow category of mitzvot. Then there are other mitzvot where you've fulfilled the mitzvah by just doing the action, and that's it. And, you know, if you want the... So for what purpose do you need the inner element there? So in the hesped for his machatenista, it's interesting that there's no English word for that. In that hesped, he said that that without the inner element, he would have grown up, what was it, a soulless being, dry and insensitive. In other words, he's saying that even in mitzvot, where you don't need the inner element for the technical halachic fulfillment, still you need to be an individual with a little, you know, lachluchit, as they say in Hebrew. You need to have some warmth, some passion, something inside, something inspired. There's a third consequence of this, which I'd like to speak to, which the Rav didn't really address so much in his published writings, but having had access to his unpublished writings, which I can't quote from until they're published, but it's also available in publicly available tapes, just those that haven't been printed yet. So I'm going to quote from sources that are publicly available. But this is an issue which he develops much more in his soon-to-be-published writings. And that is, if a person lacks the inner component of Judaism, then he won't be able to formulate a proper hashkafa of Judaism. Because in terms of halacha, if you want to know what to do when a milchik spoon falls into a fleishik pot, so you pull out your yoredeya, you open it up, and there's an answer black on white. Maybe at some point there was a machlokes, but we have a mechanism for deciding machlokes in halacha. You have, you know, majority decision, and we have a methodology of psak in terms of the outer manifestation of halacha. However, what about the inner element of halacha? What do you do? Should you be a person who follows rachmim or din? Should you be a chassid or a misnaged? Should you be a person who has the democratic educational philosophy of Beis Hillel, of admitting anyone into your school, or the elitist educational philosophy of Beis Shammai? How do you know how to paskin? Should we take a majority vote? Should we look in the Shulchan Aruch of Hashkafa? There is no way, he said. What a person has to do, this is something that can only be developed from one's experience of God, from one's inner sensitivity to the values of Judaism. This is something that, in other words, it's not just enough to know what to do, but you also have to have seichel. I don't mean seichel in the Hebrew sense, intellect. I mean seichel in the Yiddish sense. You have to have a certain amount of religious reasonableness, of religious sensitivity, of a religious sensibility. He talked about it in some places. He used many different terms for this. In one place he called it, there's a way of religious living, which is, you know, kiyum mitzvos al pi shulchan aruch, and there's a style of religious living. You know, I can keep the shulchan aruch, you know, fully, and so can a Hasidic Rebbe, and so can, you know, the Brisker Rav, and so can the Vilna Gaon, and each person will keep the same shulchan aruch in a very different style, with a very different emphasis. And on what basis does a person have the legitimacy to choose, you know, I'm going to be someone who follows the intellect, I'm going to be someone who follows the heart? On what basis can you choose your style of religious living? He said that's based on the maturity of your religious experience. On, given that God is infinite, everyone in his soul has a certain aspect of God that he can relate to. But that's only if he has the soul, and only if he has the ability to relate to God on that level. And the Rav himself, in one piece that was published in Divrei Hashkafa, I'll read it in translation. He says that if you lack this inner religious sensitivity, if you lack the experience of Judaism, you'll become confused hashkafically. You'll do silly things in either direction, too extreme or too lax. He says, he talks about, now I don't know, you know, you can judge for yourselves whether it's still true, but he said this around 1960. He said, in America we have many young Talmidei Chachamim who can really learn a Daf Gemara and a Shach and a Taz and a Ktzos just as well as people in Europe. But what do they lack? They lack the inner dimension. They're dry. They don't get it. He says, on the one hand, the young Talmidei Chachamim in America occasionally tend to exaggerated extremism, which is frightening in its arrogance. Frequently, they move in the opposite direction, and they agree to concessions in the path of least resistance. In a word, they are perplexed in the pathways of Judaism, and this perplexity is the product of an imperfect grasp and experience of the world. He said it even more pungently in a piece that Rav Rakefet transcribed in his book, accurately called Religious Immaturity. He says, as a teacher, I can transmit my ideas to my pupils on an intellectual level. When it comes to the transmission and passing of experiences, however, I feel inadequate. The American Bentara has achieved great heights on an intellectual level. However, experientially, he's simply immature. As a result, Jewish youth is inclined and very disposed to accept extremist views. They do this to such an extent that my own students examine my tzitzis to see whether they're long enough. Once, when Rav Amital first met the Rav in the 70s, he said something similar to him. I've heard him say this many times, and Rav Lichtenstein repeats it, because it's something he might not say to his family, but he said it to Rav Amital. He said, you know, my students, if I would tell them I'm giving shiur at 3 in the morning, they would all show up there. He said, but in their hearts, they think I'm an apikaris. And he's saying the same thing. So he says, our youth are extremely pious, but they're also very inconsiderate. Sometimes they drive matters to absurdity. Why? Because they have no experience. Their experience is very childish. It's simply infantile. That's why they accept all types of fanaticism and superstition. Sometimes they're even ready to do things which border on the immoral. They lack the experiential component of Judaism and simply substitute obscurantism for it. I've never seen so much naive and uncritical commitment to people and ideas as I see in America. This is the main problem we have today. Now, it's not just that a person will be perplexed, but the Rav has a whole doctrine of, and it should be pashut to people today, that each person is unique. Each person was placed by God in the world at a certain place in a certain time with certain talents to fulfill a certain mission. And each person has to create himself in the image of what he should be, given what the talents that God gave him and the position God placed him in. What should he now do with himself? It's up to him to do it. But if he's tzedreit and he doesn't have an understanding of Judaism, an understanding of the values of the inner component of Judaism, then he's never going to reach his own personal fulfillment either. Now, this is, by the way, why the Rav, as opposed to many other Rosh Yeshiva, never told anyone what to do. In other words, if you would come and ask him, you know, my spoon fell into a pot, so he would pull out his Yoredeya and he'd tell you what to do. But if you would say, should I make Aliyah? Should I take this job? Should I marry this person? Should I, you know, whatever? He couldn't tell you. It's not that he was being, you know, modest. He'd say, it's illegitimate for me to tell you. It's immoral for me to tell. I can't tell you. Only you know what's right for yourself. He said, I can't tell you how to be you. He said, if I tell you what to do, then I'm telling you to be me. Do what I would do. He said, that's ridiculous. That's why we don't take a majority decision in Paskin issues of Hashkafa or personal derech on the basis of, because that would imply that everyone's the same. Now, educationally, where does this leave us? The problem is that in order to gain the internal dimension of Judaism, you can't teach it in a classroom, you can't open up a book. It's something that you gain by exposure to exemplars of religious depth and integrity. It's something you gain through osmosis. I'll just read you one other line. You know, I learned one important thing from Rav Schechter. If you have a person who writes so beautifully and can say it better than anyone else, so read what he said, don't paraphrase. More than one thing, but that was one of the things that I thought was very important. The Rav says, Judaism is not only intellectual but an experiential tradition. And he goes on and on about the warmth and tenderness. He says, these qualities of the warmth and tenderness and fire of Judaism cannot be described in cognitive terms. One may behold them, feel them, sense them. It is impossible to provide one with a formal training in the experiential realm. Experiences are communicated not through the word, but through steady contact, through association, through osmosis, through a tear or a smile, through dreamy eyes and a soft melody, through the silence at twilight and the recital of Shema. Now, just to state in three sentences, what does this mean educationally? The Rav felt that since in traditional Jewish society, people breathed this in the air, the whole experience of Judaism, you know, he talks about how in Europe, they weren't just Shomrei Shabbos, but they were Erev Shabbos Jews. They loved the Shabbos. They went into it with beating hearts and excitement. So he said, but today, in the uprooted society in America, it lacks the ability to soar, and it lacks the roots, and it's not only unable to convey the experiential tradition of Judaism, but it's even unaware that it's supposed to do it. So you can't get it from your surrounding society anymore. You can't get it from your family anymore. It becomes the job of the teacher. And it becomes the job of the teacher to try to make manifest what would normally be kept inside, and to discuss in an open manner his religious experience, his feelings, which is what the Rav himself did, as Rav Schachter pointed out. I would submit that while this makes the teacher's job much more difficult and much more fraught, because there's still a balance that a person has to keep between revelation and concealment, and it's not appropriate for him to share everything. And of course, it depends on the age of the students and the nature of your connection with them and so on. I would submit that, to close, that while the Rav really places a great burden upon the teacher, that now he's responsible not just for conveying the information of Judaism, but the very experience of Judaism in a very open way, as opposed to a teacher who in previous generations would convey this just through example, but without making things explicit, I think that there might be more potential in Israel to return to a sort of an integrated life, society, community, family atmosphere of Judaism more than in America. And I think that the burden that it places upon the people in this audience is to try to create, to try to return to the ideal form of conveying the experience of Judaism, which is one where family and society and one's surroundings are really breathing this in a way that will convey it to the child and to the adult in a manner that he can not be perplexed in the pathways of Judaism and not follow a path of exaggerated extremism in one direction or another. And so it's not just in the hands of the teachers anymore, but it's in the hands of each and every one of us within his family and within his community.
I want to just begin by saying that the honor is really mine to join Rabbi Schachter and this distinguished panel and to be part of this this Atid gathering. This issue of intellect and emotion really gets the question of what are our goals in Jewish education as a teacher? What is my goal when I walk into the classroom every day? What are my goals for the week, for the month, for the year? So, of course, on the one hand, we have the goal of teaching our students to become knowledgeable, skilled readers of Mikorot, analytical, critical thinkers. And on the other hand, we have the emotional goal. We want them to be Ohavei Hashem, Yirei Shamayim, Ovdei Hashem. Why are these two goals often in tension with one another? Part of the difficulty is that from the student perspective, the atmosphere which promotes the goal of becoming analytical thinkers and logical thinkers, critically analyzing the opinions in the Gemara, discussing the strengths and weaknesses of the Rishonim's approach to the Gemara or to the Pasuk, whatever it may be, come to a conceptual understanding of each one. That's not the atmosphere that on the surface lends itself to the development of Ahavat Hashem and Yirat Shamayim and all of that. These are mind-focused rather than heart-focused activities. We believe as teachers, and we probably even tell the students, that learning Torah is a method of serving God. But it is not perceived as an emotional experience and not inspiring for the average student. On the other hand, what do the students feel is inspiring? Sources are experiences that move them emotionally. It can be a moving story from the Talmud, an emotional passage in Tanakh, a tish with beautiful singing, a tiyul with breathtaking views of the land that Hashem graciously gave us. But how many of those experiences do the students have every week in a Gemara or a Tanakh class? Take a Talmud shiur. We want the students to cover a certain number of dafim, including learning to read them properly, vocabulary, Bekiut, Rishonim, analysis. We spend a lot of time working to accomplish the emotional goals. The intellectual goals. Where do we fit in the emotional? So one thing that I think we need to do is to actually have in our lesson plans, teachers need to have in our lesson plans, and goals for the segment that we're teaching, an explicit goal for ourselves of getting to the emotional side with a specific plan of how to do it. The methods of achieving this goal might include what students generally view as inspirational elements, even if they are not strictly part of the curriculum. And we also need to help the students find inspiration and an emotional connection even to the rigorous and challenging Talmud Torah itself. This is in keeping with many of the things we've heard today and with Professor Tursky's point that halacha is empty of meaning only if you look at it as dry, legal material. But every detail becomes vibrant and meaningful when we understand it as part of the way in which we connect to God. I think this is best communicated by a teacher's own passion and excitement for the learning that comes through. This sort of passion is contagious. The Rav speaks about learning the warmth of Shabbat from his mother. I know that I have had teachers who've transmitted that feeling to me. And in my own teaching, I've seen sometimes the contagion that can happen with this excitement. I remember one time a very fierce debate that took place in a 10th grade intermediate level Gemara class that I was giving. The students were jumping out of their seats and running to the board to explain, which, with great passion, which was the best kinyan, Meshicha, Mesira, or Hagba. Not exactly the stuff of teenage passion, usually. That was a moment that of passion for learning, of excitement, of emotional excitement about learning. But this is a challenge at which I know that I as a teacher, and I think that all of us, all those of us who are teachers, continually need to work on. We need to sincerely feel that passion in order to transmit it. And not just passion for the learning and excitement about the learning, but also that sense of closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If we don't feel it, then we can't transmit it. In addition to making the emotional element part of our plans as teachers, it is critical, I think, that this goal is also clearly stated to the students. Educational research has shown that goals are actually more successfully attained even if they are made explicit, even given the same educational experiences. You could have the same teacher, same class, same everything, but if you said what the goal was, it will more likely be achieved. To illustrate this idea, I remember that in the first few years that I was teaching at Mayanot Yeshiva High School for Girls in Teaneck, in New Jersey, the students would sometimes say that we don't have enough hashkafa or inspiration. They don't feel inspired. So I was surprised, because it was my impression at least, that I would often stop in the middle of the Gemara that we were teaching to tell an inspiring story or to make a hashkafic point based on the Gemara. One year I decided that I was going to establish that the last 10 minutes of every week, on Friday or Thursday, whenever it was, I would give a Dvar Torah, and each week I chose something from the Parsha that I thought would be inspirational to them, and I would say it over. At the open house that year, when some students were asked to describe my class, one of the first things they mentioned was that each week we end with some inspiration. When I made it kavua and conscious, rather than ad hoc and under the radar, I think there were two results. One was that when it's ad hoc, it's hard for me to even know whether it's really happening. It was my impression that I was doing it, but maybe I was mistaken. But secondly, the students took notice, and I think it gave them a different impression of the goals of our shiur, and perhaps, hopefully, of the endeavor of learning. Furthermore, in order to achieve any goal, we must measure our progress towards that goal. Of course, this is much easier when you're measuring knowledge or skills. You can give a test. You can give an unseen text for them to analyze. And you can see, you can measure how far we've come. This is much more difficult when measuring ephemeral goals, such as religious commitment or a sense of inspiration. However, if we never measure whether we are accomplishing this goal of the emotional connection that the students have to Torah and to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then we can not fine-tune our approach as we might if we gave an exam and discovered that the whole class didn't understand this passage, nor can we ever know if we are succeeding. I think that along with clearly stated goals and plans for achieving them, we might want to consider what success would look like and devise systems to help us notice whether or not we're coming closer to this goal as each month or semester or year goes by. In closing, after relating to the emotional goals, which are often more elusive, I want to just mention that often our intellectual goals are not necessarily met that impressively. Students, at least the products of day schools in America, I can't speak about the school system in Israel yet, but students of day schools in America know precious little after 12 years of fairly expensive education. This is partially, I think, because we don't have a telescopic approach to the curriculum where we hold students accountable year by year, and that's something that, you know, seems relatively easy to fix, although not many places do it. But I think it also may be because of the emotional goals. Students are more excited by new material, and so we don't necessarily go over things that we've done in the past, and are we perhaps compromising our intellectual goals as a result? These are issues that I think need more thought, obviously further analysis, so that we can succeed in guiding our students to not only be knowledgeable, to be extremely knowledgeable in the intricacies of Shabbos, of Hilchos Shabbos, but as well as experience and ultimately transmit to their children the warmth of Shabbos and that gentle presence of Hashem's hand on their shoulders.
I want to thank you for the privilege of being here, and thank the panelists. You know, in thinking about Rav Schechter's comments and citing the Rav, I thought that in addition to just looking at the question of mitzvot in terms of the question of intellect and emotion, or of kiyum and pu'ula and manifestation in essence, I think one could actually look at the whole function of education in terms of the same type of question of what is the essence of education and what is the manifestation of education, in the same way one can about mitzvot and about the mitzvot that the Rav draws out in such a way, and see what actually happens in that sense. Because when there is a teacher in school and there are students in a class, one is certainly dealing with the manifestation of education. The teacher is teaching, the kids are sitting there, the kids are being tested, and that's in essence happening. However, whether the essence of education is taking place or not is really a separate question. And I think that in the same way we can see it with mitzvot and with religion in large, the same question applies in a very similar way in terms of what's happening in education itself. And, you know, to take some of the examples that we had previously, the experiential aspect of mitzvot and what mitzvot mean is also a very critical question in terms of what's happening in education. What is the experience that the kids are having? What does it mean for them? What does learning go ahead and do for them? And I think in that sense, being an educator and being a teacher presents a tremendous challenge. I mean, the Rav spoke about in the Hesped, he spoke about the fact that he learned something from his father and something from his mother. From his father, he learned the Hilchot of Shabbat, and from his mother, he learned what Shabbat is, what it means. An educator or a teacher has to somehow be able to both pass on the role of the father in terms of teaching the Hilchot of Shabbat, but he must also go ahead, he or she, passed on the role of the mother and teaching on what is the experience of Shabbat. And being able to play both of those roles simultaneously, or at least making sure that within an institution, children are exposed to both of those roles and have both of those roles, really becomes a very formidable challenge. Teachers have to both have the knowledge and the ability to transfer the intellect and do that in an effective way, but they must also have the passion. They must also have the presence of being and in both in their implicit mannerisms and their actions and in their behavior, manage to convey to the students implicitly what the meaning of this is and how it is. And as Meir pointed out early, and Rabbi Ziegler, they also must at times make that explicit and talk about that as well. Because often the implicit messages, although there, if not brought up to consciousness, are not fully internalized and not fully being made aware of in terms of what happens with the students. Similarly, and I think here it's a question in terms of teachers and their attitudes towards what's happening to the class and what's happening to the students. You know, there's a difference in terms of the kiyum and the pu'ula. The pu'ula of teaching is difficult. One has to prepare a good class and have a curriculum and have a lesson plan and go up there and cover the material and teach it. And that certainly is the pu'ula of teaching. But oftentimes, there's a gap between what the teacher thought he taught or what he actually did teach and what the students actually learned and what the students received. And the teacher says, I taught it, does not necessarily mean that the students learned it, got it, understood it, or experienced it in that kind of way. And one of the roles of a teacher, therefore, is to also have some awareness of where his kids are at, where the class is at, where are they. If I'm giving them a Musr Shmooze, what are they hearing? Are they hearing Musr? Are they hearing what I'm saying? Do they understand what they did wrong and how they need to fix it in some way? Or are they hearing a teacher, you know, being irritating and going on and just speaking to them in a way which they just find annoying and inappropriate or unfair or boring or any of the above? And therefore, one of the challenges is actually trying to teach in such a way, which is not at all a simple challenge, where actually the pu'ula of teaching and what it means actually goes ahead and resembles what I think the kiyum of teaching should go ahead and do. And in that kind of situation, a teacher not only has to be able to be giving implicit messages and talking also about experience, he also needs to have an awareness of where his class is at and where the kids are at and what they're hearing And whether what he's trying to give over is what they're hearing, or does he need to do it in a different way, in this kinds of way, what will be effective, what won't be effective? And again, it makes the task of a teacher an extremely formidable one, who needs to always be looking at different aspects in different ways in different things. The third aspect, and I think this is another aspect where the question of the emotion in teaching is really, really significant and goes beyond the intellect. In addition to the experience, in addition to being able to understand where he's at and to what extent the student is internalizing it, one of the things that emotion is able to provide is emotion actually allows one to have a personal connection to what's happening, to what's going there. The intellect is something that's fairly objective, it's fairly public, it's something that, you know, is examined from without, and it's something that's outside of me to a large extent. When I go ahead and deal with something emotionally, what I'm actually doing is bringing my own subjectivity into it. I'm bringing my own personal being into what's going on. I'm somehow connecting this material to me in a personal kind of way. And I think one of the really important functions of emotion in that kind of sense is to go ahead and do that. You know, for an example, and this is, you know, an example more from psychology in some sense, but just from our being, you know, when we walk into our homes, most of us have this feeling that we're home. It's familiar. It's something that we connect to. It's something that makes us feel at ease. It's something that makes us feel at home. It's a place of our own. What part of the goals that we want to do in terms of education and learning as well is to also somehow have the students achieve that kind of sense that there's some part of Torah, there's some part of Kedusha, there's some part of their relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, or some part of that which connects to them into some kind of sense, which they call their own, which they can call their own home, which is something that relates to them in a very personal kind of way. And that's something that can most of the time be achieved almost exclusively through emotion. And furthermore, in that respect, and I don't know how much people are following the scene in Israel in general in terms of educationally, you know, in the time that we live in right now, with the emphasis on individuality and authenticity and people finding themselves and connecting to things, in that respect, that aspect of the emotion becomes very critical as well. How do we help the students go ahead and connect to things? How do we help them find something which they can call their own, which is way beyond just the intellect thing? One way, for example, and it's one of the things that we've been doing somewhat in the Beit Midrash that we set up at NOGO with the help, support, ideas, and participation of Atid, is that one of the things that's important to do is to help students find things that they connect to, give them a choice, give them a variety of kinds of things, and also encourage them to find things they want to learn at all on their own. One of the things we're doing in the 9th and 10th grade over there is actually giving kids an opportunity to choose things they want to go ahead and learn with guidance, with supervision, with going ahead and following up on it, but giving them a chance to learn something they're interested, they plan, they help set the goals for themselves, and going ahead and following it, which gives a chance for real personalization, real choice of what they want to do. Another thing that's really, really important, which is sometimes hard to do within a classroom setting, is to really make teaching more individual. Where does this kid need help? Where does he need to grow? How does he need to grow? How can we help this particular student grow in this particular kind of way? Which is also something which helps the student to connect emotionally, see how it's theirs, own it for themselves, buy it, and somehow emotionally connect and personally connect to it. Rabbi Sacks actually started off this evening with the metaphor of the chariot and the intellect, the emotion pulling in two different kinds of directions. You know, often when one goes and sees educational institutions or when one sees teachers, one sees, and it's quite natural, people pulling in one direction or another. And one sees in some institutions where there's a tremendous emphasis on the learning, there's a tremendous emphasis on how much they cover and how many Dapei Gemara and how much they've gone ahead and done, and the emphasis ends up being very, very intellectual. And then one sees other kinds of institutions where the emphasis is much more on the experiential, spiritual part, where there's much more emphasis, for example, on yeshivot now, which do a lot of tiulim, where there's much more emphasis on studying and experience chassidut in various kinds of ways. I think, and Lichtenstein pointed that in the article 40 years ago, one of the unique things that the Rav went ahead and developed over here, and I think one of the challenges that he very much sets before us, and one of his chidushim, is that it's specifically through the halacha, and through that kli, and through the intellect, that there's also an opportunity to really deepen our emotional experience and our emotional experiential connection. And that kind of combination, and that way of both showing it to the students and having them experiencing it, and learning that both of those things can be intimately connected, not only can be, but need to be intimately connected. That's an essential part of what Judaism is, and both of those aspects have to be there. is, I think, a great informal challenge that Rav Soloveitchik set up in front of us in terms of us following in some way, and a very important challenge in terms of education at large.
There's a fascinating story, which is all the more fascinating because Rabbi Soloveitchik apparently used to tell it. It's a story about the Rav's great-grandfather, the Brisker Rav, for whom Rabbi Soloveitchik was named, that he had a student who went on to be, the Beis Halevi had a student that went on to become the Biala Rebbe, a Chassidish Rav. But before he became a Chassidish Admor, he was a student or a Talmid Chaver of the Beis Halevi. So once, after becoming an Admor, he somehow convinced the Beis Halevi to come to a Tish. The Beis Halevi came to a Tish. The way the story is told, I think it's written in a story by Yehuda Leib Peretz. It was a cold, wintry day, and they go into the Tish and they start singing and they eat a little kugel, and the Rebbe says a vort, and the snow melts. And the birds sing, and the sun shines. And the more they sing, the more the sun shines, and the warmer it is. Until the Beis Halevi looks at his watch and says, it's time to daven mincha. At which point the snow and the ice return, and the temperature drops. Now, the story is fascinating because the Rav himself would apparently tell it. Last Shabbat, Yerushalayim was under siege, waiting for the snow that didn't come. And today, in the middle of February, it was virtually spring. So maybe our panelists had something to do with that. So I thank you all. Because you were all so well behaved at sticking to the amount of time that we gave you, we do have time for some questions and discussion from the audience. Rabbi Shapiro. Unfortunately, there's no microphone, so please speak up.
I think you're raising a very important question, which is partially that if the community First of all, I think that there are some cases in which the community lacks the ability, let's say, to give the sense of the experiential, in which case the only choice is for the school to try to do whatever it can in its limited way to achieve that. In addition, I think that perhaps it would be part of our role as teachers to point to cases in which the community does give that. I mean, there are many people, many very dedicated people in our communities, in all of our communities, who are honest to the point of losing money, let's say, in business, who are dedicated minion goers and sheer goers, and maybe we need to focus the students' attention. We spend a lot of time, I'm sure, you know, critiquing our community. Maybe we need to point out and highlight to our students the ways in which the community can teach us something.
You know, I want to differentiate somewhat between responsibility and ability, because it could be teaching is an impossible profession. That could be, it probably is an impossible profession. But if the community is not sufficiently supplying it, or if it's not sufficiently in the awareness of the students, it is the school's responsibility to do all that it can to make it more so. It doesn't mean we should become hopeless. It doesn't mean we have to do things we can't do, which we obviously can. But it does mean we have to think about it. And I also think in this particular kind of case, you know, it could be we're learning halachas of kvayitim l'Torah. Maybe it pays to bring in some community members who really do that, who come and speak about that. What does that mean? How hard is it? How is that doable? What cost does that have, professionally or not so? What gains does it have, professionally or not so? Same thing in terms of honesty and things like that. You know, it pays for people to go and talk. What are ethical dilemmas? What does that mean? It's possible to use the community and bring that in and do it in such a way that exposes it. But at the very least, I think our obligation is to take the responsibility seriously enough to really think of how we can increase the exposure of the Talmidim to that, because that's what we ultimately want from them. And how can we increase that for them? How can we increase their awareness and their internalization of some of these kinds of ideas?
Just add one sentence to the eloquent answers that were given. The Rav definitely considered the role of the teacher to be passing on the experiential element. However, in the modern era, the chiddush is that now he has to make it explicit to talk in the manner that Sally discussed, whereas traditionally he has a very beautiful passage in Uvikashta Misham and in many other places. He says this is what the Torah Shebaal Peh is. Torah Shebaal Peh is not something that's written. It's not a text that's black on white. We have it written. But really, Torah Shebaal Peh is something that's passed from person to person. It's, by its nature, something inchoate, subjective. It merges with the individuality of each person, and he passes on part of himself to the next person in the chain of Masorah when he gives it on, who in turn shapes it himself, and so on. He says this is the role of the teacher is davka, to pass on the experiential, subjective component of Judaism. It's built into his task. In other eras, he could do it just by personal example, whereas now it has to be made explicit. But I think that this points out a very important thing that A, all teachers have to keep in mind, and B, anyone who hires teachers has to keep in mind. The most important thing with the teacher, of course, he should be a good pedagogue and he should know the material. The most important thing is that he should be sincere. He should have integrity. He should believe what he says, and that communicates itself. It may not get through to everyone, but it'll get through to someone, and when it gets through, it's much more powerful than, you know, 1,000 schmoozes that are just coming from the surface. But if it means something, then it'll get through.